May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, there's a lot of talk about sheep today in our readings. I will confess the closest I've come to the pastoral settings of the sheepfold as one who was raised in the city was to visit relatives in my childhood when they still lived in the foothills of the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas on their family farms. It was cattle, not sheep. But I remember going to the pasture multiple times with my great uncle, who had this peculiar way of calling his cows in for feeding. It was made all the more odd because he was always dipping tobacco, so he had this contorted shape to his mouth when he, with a high pitch, out over the field would yell, "Sook! Sook!" Why cows would answer that, I do not know. But inevitably, they came a-running when he would do that. They knew his voice. They knew him. They knew his pattern of feeding them. Sometimes he would encourage me as a young boy to take a turn in calling the cows. I suspect more to get a laugh at me hollering foolishly, city boy that I was, "Sook, sook!" I was earnest. I was so earnest in it. But those cows just glowered at me from the field. Mine was an unfamiliar voice. Today is known as Good Shepherd Sunday, this fourth Sunday of Easter. It is a placable feast arising from the agrarian setting of our Christian roots in the ancient Near East. But if we plumb down beneath the pastoral scenes of bleating sheep or lowing cows, we will find in these scriptures, in this invitation today, a profound sense of belonging. And that's what I want to explore this morning. Framed at first by the whole of it, by our sense of baptismal belonging. Recall that the words we say to every person newly baptized here, "We receive you into the household of God." Confess the faith of Christ crucified, proclaim his resurrection, share with us in his eternal priesthood. We are all invited into the sublime reality of the household of God. And with that, we belong. In the New Testament, the Greek word for household is oikoumene, from which we derive our word economy. The oikos is also the root for ecology or ecosystem. A household is, by definition, a communal exercise, a common experience in which mutual well-being is held as an ideal ethic, even if we often fall short of it. Most of us probably imagine a nuclear family as the basic household unit. It's a good starting point, but our baptismal belonging and these scriptures here this Sunday invite us to think larger than that, much larger. So, for instance, in the Acts of the Apostles reading a few moments ago, those early church baptismal communities saw fit to share all their worldly possessions. They were all held in common and then dispersed when there was a need. There was this deep sense of a belonging centered on the table sharing a meal. We have a modern proxy for that in our own time as we present our gifts of bread and wine and our money here in this household of faith. That's what we're doing with that. I'll say more about that in a moment, but first let me turn to this passage from 1 Peter. It takes this notion of household even further. The author here is writing to Christians a half century after Jesus has died. They have scattered across the empire. They are now a Christian diaspora, and they're struggling to hold on to their faith as they straddle two worlds. the Greco-Roman culture in which they live and their Christian identity now overlaid upon it. And this letter that we know as 1 Peter is an ethical exhortation calling Christians to live a holy life in the household. Literally, it's a household code is what he spells out in the text of the letter. He suggests that may even mean suffering for your faith. It's troubling language that we hear, because in this passage, he's actually talking to the slaves of the household to submit to their masters with all deference. It stops us short. Elsewhere, the author of this letter gives a similar charge to wives to give all deference to their husbands. It's important to know that this is not the slavery we have in our American psyche from our early history in this nation, which was driven clearly by racist oppression. Race was not a determinant factor in the Roman Empire, in the slavery of the Roman Empire. It was based upon the sheer economics of indebtedness, the economics of power and patronage sought people who would take on debt. And when they couldn't repay their debts with money, they paid with their freedom. The powerful got more powerful as a result. Those who were indebted became members of another man's household, but they were never full members. That the author of this Christian letter was writing to either group, to slaves or wives, is truly remarkable. Neither was ever acknowledged in any writings in the Roman Empire. And by doing so, this author is acknowledging their membership not only in that Roman household in which they might be slaves or wives, they're members of another household too, the liberated and love-filled household of God. And he's exhorting them to live a life modeled on that of Jesus, who suffered unjustly, just as they may be now as well. He seems to say, so just suck it up. It stops us short. It's offensive even. We know that the household of the Roman paterfamilia was operated on the economics of power and shame, not on mutual well-being. The author of this letter lived in a culture in which that slavery was acceptable, in which that second-class citizenry was acceptable. It was the reality of his culture, and he could not see beyond it becoming unacceptable. So he writes the letter with that in mind. Now, that may lead us to want to chuck it off altogether. Just say it's a historical document that has no bearing for us. But is there something in this letter that invites us to draw parallels to our own time? Are there blind spots that we have in understanding the reality of our culture in the way that we don't have the mutual ethic as the ideal? How can we hear this ethical exhortation in our lives? The institution of slavery may have been abolished in this nation, but let's be clear, the vestiges of that institution are surely with us today. And if we peel it back even further, much has been written about the ways that our modern economic system really enslaves all of us by commodifying every aspect of our lives. Human value in this nation, in this city, is determined by the market system. That's the truth of it, folks. Every aspect of our lives, right down and including our relationships, has been commodified. Assign value. They become transactional. I'll give you just a brief example. If you give me a gift, I intuitively think I am obligated to give you something in return. It's the way we think. That's a transaction, though. It's not a gift. It's an indebtedness. You see the problem? We could go on and on. But the reality is that some people are assigned more value and others less. And for all of us, our sense of freedom is constrained by the rubrics of the market. People suffer. At some level, I think that's why you and I may still be coming to church. We know there must be more in life than what the imperium of transacted life can deliver. We don't want to do it that way here. And the voice of the shepherd calls us once more into a household of faith to live a different way, to believe that we really belong simply because we belong. But here's the challenge. To frame this household of God as anything less than including every human being simply fails to hear God's relentless call of love to us. To frame this household of God as anything less than the entire universe, the entire fragile earth, our ecosystem, is anathema to God's vision. What does it mean to embrace the vision of God's economy here and now in our lives? Catherine Tanner teaches religious studies at Yale University. She says the economy of God, juxtaposed to this other, the economy of God has three prevailing characteristics. First, unconditional giving. Unconditional giving. That's where give a gift and expect nothing in return. No notoriety, no acclamation, no gift in return, just unconditional giving, and give it out of gratitude. The second, non-competitive and non-commodified relationships. They stand on their own as a thing of beauty. And the third characteristic in the economy of God is universal inclusion. That is, that no one is devalued or deemed unworthy of belonging. No one. So unconditional giving, uncommodified, non-commodified, non-competitive relationships, and universal inclusion. But those are not just attributes of God. They are the clarion call for us to embrace in our lives, to really adopt such a vision for this broken, hurting world, this household of humanity. This is the core of the shepherd's call to us, my friends. He invites us to join him in the sheepfold, which is the veritable household of God, right here, right now. The call is eternal. The call is earnest. The call is eminently hopeful in you and me. In you and me. And for that, my friends, may God's holy name be praised. Amen.